biggest problem. I think John Stuart Mill kind of comes back, doesn't he? Because he was a big, obviously, utilitarian as well, and supporter. But he said things like, I can't be free. I can't feel free unless everybody else is free.
Yes.
And this kind of thing, kind of tempering that kind of absolute. And another thing is, you know, who are we to say what happiness is? You know, it's one of the biggest questions going. And
yes,
you know, some things, I have to be careful here, some things that cause pain, people like.
tell us more about these people. Okay.
For example, you know, if you fell in love and you, and it hurt you because it ended badly, would you like that completely erased from your life? You know, or you're never gonna want to fall in love again, or you know, that's kind of thing. I think there's so much to it than that simplistic kind of approach. But I'm supposed to be defending Bentham here, aren't I?
I mean, you know, we're discussing around the issues here.
But yeah, I do. I have sympathy with this idea of let's go, you know, back to basics, basically. And look at how can we increase happiness for the greatest number. That, you know, it seems like a reasonable thing at first.
Yes. Yeah.
To want. Yeah.
I mean, there has to be. I mean, there has to be, at some level, some kind of. I don't know. I mean, maybe there's a kind of a minimal level of okay. Well, everybody ought to expect this, from life. You know. But then the more you think about that, you just think, well, what would be the base level? It's like trying to decide what's, you know, it's like, you know, people kind of, you know, patting themselves on the back for giving their workers minimum wage. You think, oh, well, at least my workers get minimum wage. Yeah, but I mean, is that really something to be to crow about? I mean, minimum wage almost by definition is the lowest possible, you know, remuneration for your work that we could possibly get away with. And is that, you know, is that ethical? I don't know. I mean, but then again, you know, should everybody be given? I mean, that's the kind of social, the kind of idealistic socialist model. Everybody should have an equal share of everything. So you know, and that never seems to work because you know, there's always somebody who's going to administer it, and there's always somebody, and whoever administers it will have some reason for having more because you know, to help them administer it. You know, has everybody got the right? I mean, we, you know, the standard thing is, well, everybody should have water. Everybody should have, you know, like, you know, bowl of rice, at least some food to eat, and everybody should have, you know, and okay, that's fine. But that's subsistence, isn't it? I mean, does everybody have the right to art? Does everybody have the right to literature? Does everybody have the right to be able to dance? You know, should you be able to have time in a day where you're free to be able to dance? You know, does everybody have the right to, you know, a garden? I mean, I'm, you know, in this whole lockdown thing, I had a garden. I mean, I know, I've been moaning and complaining about being locked down. But here I am in my garden with my beer machine. I mean, I think, you know, should everybody have a garden with a beer machine, Danny? What do you reckon? Is that part of...
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? It's like, I think it's become kind of fashionable, or, you know, or at least common in politics to say, well, we've tried all that. You know, we've tried doling out, how can I say, kind of freedoms in that way and rights in that way, and it's not worked. Let's give that up. Let's stop doing that. I was thinking of a thought experiment today. It's like, or was it yesterday? I can't remember. If you had everything you could possibly want in terms of money and power. And you've got everything into, like, property, you could just get it just like that. That should be a kind of starting point. Should that be, on the one hand, a starting point in discovering who you really are and what you really want and what is most important? Or, on the other hand, is completely stripped bare until you just got the, you know, just the barest minimum and then trying to... accept that for what it is, you know, like what is these two extremes, what is more preferable, and should you just, you know, be happy with what you got, or should you always try to you know, strive for more.
Yeah.
One last thing. This gets wrapped up with our idea, you know, in capitalism. Mm. It's like equal in capitalism. It's like if you're good at making money, then you're a successful person.
Mm.
You know, that's kind of wrapped up in that.
Yes. Yes. I mean, Kant, of course, has that kind of universal idea that, you know, you shouldn't behave in a sense, or shouldn't have an ethical principle that you wouldn't want to be enacted at all times for all people in all places. So it doesn't distinguish by circumstance. It just says, you know, it is always inappropriate. Mm-hmm. It is always ethically wrong to do this. It is always ethically right to do that. For every human being in every place at all times. You know, full stop. Kind of end of story. And there's something attractive about that in a way, because it does simplify the debates a little bit. It gives you back a kind of religious metaphysic, because it allows you to say, okay, well, I don't have to hash this out. No matter what, no matter how much you're a violent, unpleasant individual, I don't have to sit there and kind of, you know, weigh up the pros and cons. I'm not going to kill you. I'm not going to sanction having you killed, because I don't know the end result of that behavior, that action. So we are not going to do that. There are other things we'll do, but we're not going to do that. You know, I'm not going to lie about anything, because, you know, I might do it with the best of intentions, but I don't know where it's going to take us. I think he wanted that absolutism to be able to almost to kind of, you know, in a sense, to kind of stabilize the boat. I mean, he's doing in a way what Descartes did with the cogito. You know, Descartes in the 17th century says, oh, good God, you know, what do we know? And if we're genuinely saying there is no God, to kind of reinforce our belief in an external world, how in heaven's name do we know what's true anymore? Mm-hmm. And then, as we know, he says, okay, well, let's just start from scratch. You know, I think, therefore I am. I know that I exist. That's my baseline, you know. Mm. And then we can build up our kind of belief in rationality and build up our confidence in the external world and that. And Kant's doing the same, I think, in the Critique of Practical Reason, where he's trying to say, okay, you know, dear Lord, we don't know, you know, what's true. We don't know how we should behave anymore. So let's get back to the basics here. And the basics are, it's universal. You know, you don't do anything that you would not want to be done at all times in all places for everybody. That's that's the basis. Whereas, as you say, with Bentham, it's a much more movable feast. Which kind of tends to render ethics relative, does it not?
Mm. Yes. Yeah, so that's another thing. I was reading. John Stuart Mill's critique of that. So he was saying that, yeah, we can't just keep making every day drawing up whether this is right or wrong.
Mm.
You know, so one of the examples I found in a philosophy book was speeding.
Mm.
You know, just because it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you're in a place that there's, you know, almost guaranteed to be no people or cars, you shouldn't speed at that time, because we need to have a set of rules in that area. We can't keep amending that constantly, because it's almost the same as having everyone do what they want.
Yes. And once you do that, it creates or could be seen as creating a kind of recipe for its own disaster. Because if you say, okay, well, you know, you must always travel at 70 miles an hour in the UK, you know, on a motorway, no faster than that. But then it's kind of, oh, well, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, you can. Or, you know, between 2 o'clock and five, well, it doesn't really matter. It creates that sense in which this is not actually an absolute law. It is really just a provisional law which changes with circumstance. And if this is a law that can change with circumstance, well, every law can change with circumstance. I will always. I mean, I'm an ardent critic of the hazard warning light. I mean, I can see how it was originally, the hazard warning lights on a car. I can see the original purpose, and the original purpose was to kind of warn people when you'd broken down and you were a danger to oncoming traffic or a danger to traffic. You put on these lights as a warning to let people know that something is not right here. Mm. Now they've just become shields. So instead of kind of raising, you know, so basically you put your hazard warning lights on. You've just basically, from the start, you've raised the shields. Nothing can nothing can happen to you when the hazard warning lights are on. You can park outside my chip shop up the road from me in a very narrow road, preventing buses from both directions and lorries and cars, very busy traffic. You can do that as long as your hazard warning lights are on. Because if your hazard warning lights are on, you've created an ethicless bubble, an ethical, ethics-free bubble. Yeah. It's also immune to the laws of physics. You're not going to get hit. You're not going to cause any harm. So I'm thinking that those hazard warning lights suddenly create a new environment. Well, I've got hazards on, so I can park there. Now, why don't you just park around the back of the chip shop like everybody else? Oh, no, I want to get my pie and chips. And I don't want to park around the back. And
yeah, don't worry, I've got the hazard warning lights on.
Hazard warning lights are on, so everybody knows that. No harm can come. And there's always that kind of... And I think people create those kind of justifications, which start to just make a kind of utilitarian sort of ethic. Well, you know, I'm getting greatest pleasure, I'm getting pie and chips. It's great, you know. It just kind of waters it down, whereas Kant is saying, no, there are no circumstances, no matter how trivial, in which you could water this down. And that establishes not just for that particular law, that particular event, it sets the agenda for the entire ethical system. Yeah. That this is not a compromise in any way. You don't tweak with this.
You have chaos.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was a cyclist, no more a cyclist.
Yeah.
When I was a cyclist, there was this quite a steep hill, and so I was always in England, in the UK. It's like it's you must stay on the road. In other countries, they're a bit more relaxed about that, but you must stay on the road, and I was diligently doing that. But there was this steep hill, and the road became very narrow because of parked cars. So. As you go up on a cycle, then you start to build up traffic behind you.
Yeah.
Lots of cars coming up this steep hill. And there's a lovely path right next to it.
Mm.
There's a lovely welcoming path there with nobody on there. So I did that a few times. And I think someone had to go at me once for about it. And they were quite correct about it. But I kept thinking that if I stayed on that cycle, then I'm going to cause much more mayhem. So if I stayed on the path on the road, I'm going to cause much more mayhem than going onto that empty path. What do you think?
Did you feel like a bad boy though? I mean, intuitively, did you feel like, oh, I'm breaking the rules here? You know,
in a good way. I feel guilty.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I mean, there was an intuition here. There was an ethical intuition where you thought to yourself, actually. I know what you mean. It's just not easy to come up with a resolution to this because you could say, well, there's an intuition. I know, and the Christian tradition and a number of other religions have this idea that there is, you know, they almost argue that the image of God in humanity is human conscience. Not consciousness, but conscience. The ability to know what is right and wrong. And, you know, in a way, you know, Plato says much the same thing, that we know what's right and wrong. It might be minimally when it's pointed out to us. When we point it out, well, if you, you know, this is a bad thing and this is a good thing for these reasons. Plato says, you know, as soon as it's shown to you, it will make sense and you couldn't possibly operate in any other way because why would you? You know, don't put sugar in the petrol tank because you do that. This is what happened. Oh, really? Okay, well, I will never do that because it will be stupid to do anything else. And Plato says that's how this works. But then you kind of think to yourself, but intuition. I mean, intuition could simply be custom and habit. It could just be the way the way one was brought up, and the kind of the kind of TV you watched, the kind of school you went to, the kind of parents you had, and your ethics may simply be what was handed down, and that gets muddied, doesn't it? Because you've got that on the one side that basically I am what I am because my mother was a good sort. You know, she was always very friendly to other people, never did harm to anybody. You know, so I thought, well, you know, she taught me a lot. Maybe that's why I am who I am. Not that I'm necessarily a particularly good person, but that, you know, maybe I'm following my mother's footsteps. But then on the other hand, you have people who, you know, children who rebel against parental influence, say, oh, well, my family were like this, so sod that, I'm going to go my own way. Mm. So I think, you know, so the idea of kind of having an intuitive ethic, a kind of like a Jiminy Cricket, like an inner ethical voice, I think that's way too relativistic as well, because, you know, where's that voice come from, you know? you start listening to the voices in your head, Danny, you know where that leads you.
Right? But yeah, I think it is not straightforward, is it? Like, you learn, you get punished for, you know, doing stuff. I'm just going to take, you know, just take those sweets. And my brother's sweet, I should take them. Is there anything in there, in that your thinking that's, you know, before you get taught that it's bad, that maybe it's not good? Is it just thinking about the consequences?
Maybe. But then that brings us back to how far, you know, how far forward, how far ahead do you want to evaluate the consequences? So you might say, okay, well, you know, I'm going to do this. I'm going to lie now to somebody. And I've thought about it. I thought, if I tell this lie, you know, that I've said that, you know, yeah, I don't know, my mother's had her hair done, and I've said to her, she doesn't listen to the cast, so it doesn't matter. If I say, you know, mum says, oh, I've had my hair done, and I say to her, oh, that looks really good, whereas actually I think it's rubbish. You know, I might think, well, that's a harmless white lie. We use that term, yeah, it's a white lie. You know, it's not going to do anybody any harm. But then what happens if I did that and my child, as a youngster, was next to me and she heard me say that? And she just took it in. And then, you know, later on as she grew up, she started to say, well, you know, you can lie to people just to make them feel good. So, okay, you know, because I remember my dad lying to his mother to make her feel good and didn't want to upset her. So I'm in this relationship
white
now.
Lies.
Yeah, I'm in a relationship now, and I might be in a relationship now with, well, I don't know, she's not, but I might be in a relationship now with an abusive partner. But I'll lie to him and tell him or her and tell them that, you know, everything's fine, it's okay, because I don't want to upset them, I don't want to make things worse, you know. So, you know, or, you know, I'm at work and, you know, I'll lie to my boss and say, oh yeah, you know, I'll happily do that and I'm perfectly happy in my job and, you know, it's all great. Or, you know, we don't know how far, and that might only appear, that might only manifest itself 20 years down the line. After you've made that initial lie to your mother about how good you think her hair is, 20 years later, when your kid is 25, 30, that lie may come home to roost in a form of behaviour. Are you thinking every time you make a judgment? Okay, how far forward am I going to be thinking? Am I talking about the influence this has over the next few weeks, over the next year, 5 years, 10 years? How far am I responsible for my ethical actions?
Would Nietzsche have something to say about this, wouldn't I guess? He would say, you know, this is the fact that you're thinking about that, that is a kind of the guilt, you know, the kind of life denying part, isn't it?
But he'd say suck it up, though, wouldn't he? I mean, I'm sure Nessa would put us right on this on the webpage at our Facebook site. But I think his attitude is, you know, that's part of the will to power, is not to be incapacitated by this, to be able to say, yeah, I don't know necessarily everything that's going on, but I'm going to make this judgment now, and, you know, let the chips fall where they may. Don't be a wuss here. Whereas all the sheep are milling around, going, oh no, I don't know. Somebody tell me. Bear. You know, and they just say, no, don't do that. Don't be milling around, bleating about, you know, somebody take a lead, somebody tell me what to do. Which is kind of, I guess, what Kant is saying. You know, there has to be an absolute telling you what to do. He just said, no, you know, do it, and then take responsibility for where it ends up, you know.